Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was working in a coffee shop in Boston to like help pay rent while I was training for the trials. And so people kept joking. They're like, oh, yeah, she just took a 2-hour coffee break and went and ran the Olympic trials marathon.
On the Podium is back with more Olympians and Paralympians sharing their journeys to the top. On the Podium from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 17th of August. The prosecutor in the US state of Georgia says Donald Trump's trial on election interference should begin in March, right in the middle of the Republican primary season. Pakistan deploys troops in Punjab province to control Muslim crowds who attack Christian homes and churches. And more than 60 migrants are presumed dead after their vessel sank near Cape Verde off the west coast of Africa. Also in the podcast, the British Museum sacks a member of staff after items from its collection disappeared. And the Netherlands' radical plan to put an end to this in schools.
Teachers end up having big fights with the students, asking them to hand in their phones, and the kids will say, no, it's my property, you can just take it from me.
Donald Trump has a busy few months ahead of him. Not only is he campaigning for the US presidential election next year, he is also facing 4 separate trials. The latest charges were brought against him this week in the state of Georgia, following the infamous phone call when he asked an official to, quote, find 11,780 votes so he could beat Joe Biden. The district attorney has proposed the trial should start in early March, right in the middle of the Republican primary election season. Before his first appearance in court due next month, the former president must be booked in at the Fulton County Jail, which is already under heavy police guard. Here's what people in the area thought about Mr. Trump being charged.
I don't want to see that happen to nobody. I don't want nobody to go down, especially the leader of the free world. But right is right, and what? Wrong is wrong.
Well, no, it shouldn't be like that just because they don't like him. No, he had to do something wrong in order to go. They don't pin that on me because he don't like him. Send him to jail. That don't sound too good to me.
I think it's well deserved. He's done a lot of stuff in the background and underhanded stuff. It's time for him to pay for his whatever he done.
With more details of the legal process, here's Wira Davis in Washington.
Donald Trump and the other 18 defendants accused of seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 election have already been told to surrender or present themselves at Georgia's Fulton County Jail before Friday the 25th of August, when it's reported they may have mugshots taken and be fingerprinted. The district attorney or prosecutor bringing the case against the former president has now asked the court that Mr. Trump should also be arraigned, have the charges against him formally presented in the first full week of September. The prosecutor, Fannie Willis, who Mr. Trump has accused of leading a politically motivated witch hunt against him, also requested the court to approve a provisional trial date of March the 4th. Mr. Trump has said he will present his own investigation next week, which he says will completely exonerate him of allegations of racketeering and election meddling. The setting of a trial date in Georgia, which still has to be agreed by a judge, is important, given the many other criminal and civil cases being faced by Mr. Trump and his intention to stand as the Republican candidate in next year's presidential election.
Wira Davis in Washington. Next to an update on a story we reported on in the last edition of the Global News podcast from Pakistan, where hundreds of Muslim men have gone on the rampage in a town near Faisalabad. It came after 2 Christians were accused of desecrating pages of a Quran. Well, accusations of blasphemy like that are dealt with extremely harshly in Pakistan. Punishments include the death penalty. Although there is no record of anyone actually being put to death by the authorities, dozens of alleged blasphemy suspects have been killed by lynch mobs and vigilantes. In this latest instance, government officials say troops were called in after the crowds torched Christian churches and houses. The protesters had been encouraged by local Muslim leaders. From Islamabad, here's Caroline Davis.
Pakistan's social media is full of videos showing a cross being torn down from the roof of a church in Jaranwala before the building is set alight. Others show angry protesters surging through the narrow streets of the city's Christian areas, chanting slogans while burning furniture taken from nearby homes. One minister said over 7,000 angry protesters came out on the streets of Jaranwala after they heard about an alleged incident of the desecration of the Quran. Police told the BBC that they had registered a case under the blasphemy law against two Christian brothers who were accused of tearing pages out of the Quran early this morning.
Caroline Davis. Well, rights groups say blasphemy allegations in Pakistan can be misused to target religious minorities or to settle scores. Uma Nangiana from the BBC Urdu service told me more about the relations between Muslims and Christians in the affected area.
Normally, it's very cordial. I mean, there's never been a problem. The minority Christian community has been living there for a very long time, maybe over 100 years there in Jaranwala. There's never been any serious trouble other than the blasphemy accusations and allegations that we see occasionally in different areas of Pakistan. There's been trouble in some parts of Faisalabad district, which is the same district where Jaranwala also lies, but not specifically in this town. And people have been living very cordially there. The relations have been really good. But whenever, you know, there is this incident of alleged blasphemy, then there are troubles, there are tensions. And that is exactly what is happening right now in Jaranwala. People are saying that the situation is very tense. Some of them have left their houses. They're not returning home because they fear that the violence may spill over.
Uma Nangiana from the BBC Urdu service in Islamabad. Well, speaking at a news conference in Washington on Wednesday, Vedant Patel of the US State Department said the reports from Pakistan were worrying and called for an end to the violence.
We are deeply concerned that churches and homes were targeted in response to reported Quran desecration in Pakistan. We support peaceful freedom of expression and the right to freedom of religion and belief for everybody. And as we have previously said, we are always concerned of incidents of religiously motivated violence. And we urge Pakistani authorities to conduct a full investigation into these allegations and call for calm for all of those involved.
U.S. State Department spokesman Vedant Patel. More than 60 migrants are thought to have drowned after their boat sank off the coast of Cape Verde in West Africa. Most of them were from Senegal and Sierra Leone. Ana Pizarro reports.
The vessel was first spotted on Monday by a Spanish fishing boat 300 kilometres off the island of Sal in Cape Verde. Local police estimate 100 people were initially on board, most of them from Senegal and Sierra Leone. 38 people survived, some needed hospital treatment. Cape Verde is not on any particular migrant route, as the archipelago is about 600 kilometres off the West African coast. Its waters are dangerous, with high waves and frequent wind changes. But the treacherous route does lie on the way to Spain's Canary Islands, a gateway used by migrants trying to reach the European Union.
Ana Pizarro. When the head of Niger's presidential guard seized power 3 weeks ago, he said he was acting because of a worsening security situation. Niger, like neighbours Mali and Burkina Faso, has been struggling to deal with a jihadist insurgency, which has plagued the Sahel region for more than a decade. Under President Mohamed Bazoum, violence in Niger had actually been falling. But since his ousting, there have been 7 jihadist attacks on the armed forces. The latest on Wednesday left 17 soldiers dead. Our West Africa correspondent Chris Iwoko told me what the military authorities are saying about the incident.
They had a military convoy that was on patrol duty. They came under attack. It was an ambush mounted by some armed groups. And in the attack, 17 soldiers were killed. 20 others were injured.
Is it the fact that the sort of instability following the coup seems to have led to an increase in jihadist attacks?
This is what it seems. There are indications that more troops have been withdrawn from the front line to help secure, especially the capital Niamey, after threats by the ECOWAS regional bloc choosing to intervene militarily if the junta in Niger failed to reinstate President Bazoum. Security analysts actually suggest that pulling out troops from the front line could affect the fight against insurgency in the Sahel country, especially at a time that countries like the United States and France have stopped military cooperation with the junta. Again, it looks like the jihadi groups are taking advantage of the political crisis. They have succeeded in ambushing soldiers. In the last 7 attacks, close to about 50 soldiers have so far been killed.
Is this increase in attacks on the military and others, is that likely to weaken support for the coup?
Well, we've seen many people in Niger, especially in the capital, Niamey, coming out in large numbers to demonstrate, show their solidarity in support of the coup, chanting or expressing anti-West, anti-France sentiments, believing that the insurgency could have been caused by Western countries. But unfortunately, what is happening now is bound to turn the tide in a way, because at the time President Bazoum was still in power, he was taking the fight to the insurgents. And there were a reduction in activities of these armed groups. Now it's getting to escalate. If it continues, a lot of people begin to think differently and feel that perhaps the junta is not really able to contain the insurgents if they continue in power.
Chris Iwoko there in Nigeria, monitoring events in neighbouring Niger. The leaders of a wildlife trafficking gang have been convicted after a 4-year investigation. At their trial in Nigeria last month, they pleaded guilty to smuggling the scales of African pangolins, which conservationists say are being hunted to extinction. Described as top-of-the-pyramid traffickers, they were responsible for half of all illegal trade in pangolin scales. The BBC's Steve Swan talked to one of the people who went undercover to bring down the network.
Hey, brother.
A wildlife trafficker from Vietnam is in Africa to buy pangolin scales. He's on the phone to a supplier. We changed his voice because he's really an undercover investigator.
You ordered 20 ton.
Yes, I need 20 tons.
You're going to ship to Vietnam, the 20 tons?
Yes.
The investigator speaks to the gang leader.
How many days are you going to stay there?
10 days. But for the other guy, maybe 1 month or 2 months.
They don't realise their calls and movements are being monitored. A huge intelligence operation run from the secret HQ of a charity in the Netherlands meant within days of the calls, the traffickers were arrested. Now they've pleaded guilty in Nigeria to smuggling pangolin scales.
I can't underestimate the value of this trial to wildlife in Africa. These guys are at the top of the pyramid.
Steve Carmody is an ex-police officer who works for the Wildlife Justice Commission.
So we have Jeannie, Pixie, Jafar.
And a record 8 tons of pangolin scales and more than 1,000 elephant tusks have been seized from a shipping container in Hong Kong.
The investigation began in 2018 after seizures of animal parts hidden in shipping containers en route from Africa to Asia. Inside were scales stripped from the carcasses of thousands of pangolins.
They're a solitary animal. Their defence mechanism is to roll up in a ball. They can't defend themselves from us, and we're decimating them, and these guys are profiting from that, and there's no empathy at all.
Pangolins are believed to be the most trafficked mammal in the world. Their meat's eaten in Africa, their scales used in traditional medicine in China. It's estimated 1 million have been killed by traffickers in the last decade. That changed during the COVID pandemic. Shipments slowed down, so West African traffickers took to social media to find new buyers. I'm looking at one of their posts now. I can see video of sacks of pangolin scales piled up in a container and offered for sale. This was intelligence used by investigators. Van, not her real name, is a young Vietnamese woman who went undercover.
I love animals and wildlife is my passion. The animals mean nothing to them.
Here's another WhatsApp video. It's mute, but you can see Van talking to a trafficker over the phone. His code name is Jeannie, and he's wandering around his compound with about a dozen sacks of scales all stacked up off the ground. He didn't realise it, but he left vital clues, which the team passed on to the Nigerian authorities.
And within 12 hours, they'd raided the premises, arrested his brother and two other people, seized the 7.1 tonnes of pangolin scales and 800 kilos of ivory, because Jeannie gave us his address and did a video call showing us the products. It's like Pablo Escobar telling you where he lives in Colombia and showing the cocaine in his basement.
Jeannie wasn't arrested and is now on the run. But after years of feeling untouchable, he and other wildlife traffickers are finally feeling the pressure.
Steve Swan reporting. Nestled between Colombia and Peru, two of the world's largest producers of cocaine, Ecuador was until recently known as an island of peace in South America. But a recent upsurge in violence exploded into full view last week. The shocking murder of presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio, an investigative journalist who often spoke about a link between government officials and organised crime. He'd received numerous threats and wasn't wearing a bulletproof vest at the time. Polls had suggested that he had a good chance of getting through to the second round in the election on Sunday. His running mate, environmental campaigner Andrea Gonzalez, spoke to the BBC's James Menendez about the killing.
We found each other in this fight for freedom that we have for more than 15 years here in Ecuador. Fernando and I shared a vision of this country of peace. This is a paradise that they've turned into hell.
Which I guess means it's been incredibly difficult dealing with what happened and the aftermath.
Yes, Fernando was my friend. I understand that I wouldn't wish any other of the mates of the presidential candidates to go through what I'm going, but I've lost a friend. And to me, it's incredibly personal and hard to not be able to say goodbye to my friend because I'm wearing a bulletproof vest 24 hours. I think no one in Latin America should allow this in their country to happen. And it's personally a big, big loss. I feel a lot of weight on my shoulders because he always told me that I was supposed to go on with this. So it's a legacy I'm not willing to let die with him.
He was very outspoken, and particularly about the issue of drugs, gangs and violence. But were you shocked when he was shot? Did you expect that it would come to that?
No, I never imagined that it would happen in Quito, in the capital of the country, in the mid of a rally. We thought that we were in danger, yes. But we went all through the country and we were in very dangerous cities. I live in one of the most dangerous cities, which is Guayaquil. And we had all the precautions. Fernando was not being irresponsible. His message was that we should all be brave. And that you should be brave even if you do not have a bulletproof vest or if you don't have a lot of power or a lot of money or if you don't have political influence. And that's the message that he delivered. He wasn't playing with his life or putting us at risk. The actual message was we have to all be brave. Because I do believe that the good people are the majority in this country, but we do not make ourselves present in the moments where this country needs us to step forward.
Do you think, though, he could have taken more precautions given the threats against him? Do you think he should have taken more precautions?
To be honest, it wouldn't have been useful. He was shot in the head 5 times with heavy artillery. There was 20 people involved in this. This has been a shock not only for the democracy, but for the violence in this country, which has reached to unimaginable points. He was shot from a long-distance rifle. If it wasn't there in the rally, it would have been the next days. And he was shot in the head, so the bulletproof vest would have been useless. Yes, it was not supposed to be in that car. It was supposed to get in a car with all the securities and a bulletproof car. But they had everything studied and they were following us, the whole campaign. They would have done it anyway.
Andrea Gonzalez in Ecuador, talking to James Menendez. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Inshallah.
God willing, Lebanon will become an oil-producing country, so there will be a glimmer of hope for the Lebanese people.
Optimism in Lebanon as an oil rig arrives to begin exploration.
What in the World is the podcast exploring the stories and the issues that you need to know about?
93% of fast fashion workers aren't getting paid a living wage.
The former president is accused of trying to overturn democracy.
How do elite athletes train in and around their menstrual cycle?
Understand more, feel better with What in the World from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
A BBC investigation in 9 countries has found that women across Africa are struggling with period poverty. Some spend up to 13% of their monthly income on sanitary products. Gem O'Reilly has been talking to activists in Zimbabwe trying to make basic hygiene more affordable for women and girls.
Ikwe mabala bala. Ikwe
singing and waving their precious gift bags. These girls in rural Zimbabwe have just received a couple of boxes each of sanitary pads and they can't stop smiling. For some of them, these pads are the only ones they'll get all year.
It has to do with the body, the hormones and your kind of body system. If you're not bleeding so much, does that mean that...
Nokuzola Nunwandwe is a women's rights activist. She's distributing pads to a classroom packed with teenagers and to those who really need them.
Menstrual health has an impact on economic growth, particularly socioeconomic justice. And so if we want to bring about women empowerment and the eradication of pre-poverty, we need to pull in all our collective voices.
In 2019, Nokuzola successfully got the government in South Africa to scrap the 15% sales tax on sanitary pads. Activists across the continent have launched initiatives to tackle period poverty and break down the stigma still attached to periods. Ibrahim Fale is from Nigeria. He has made it his mission to raise awareness among boys about menstrual hygiene.
I feel I need to do something before it gets out of hand. So I believe with initiatives like this, all over Africa, we can counter and eradicate period poverty.
The World Bank says that at least 500 million women and girls lack the access they need to facilities during their periods. Our Pan-African BBC investigation has found that women on minimum income are spending between 3 to 13% of their monthly wage on sanitary products alone. In many cases, girls are having to resort to using newspapers, cow dung, and even transactional sex to get the products that they need. Back at the school, girls are using affirmations to build their confidence. But Nokuzola says there's still a long way to go for women and girls in Africa.
What's stopping us from fighting against eradicating pre-poverty? What's stopping us from achieving gender equality? I mean, it doesn't have to take more than 300 years. So if we work together, then we'll be able to bring in the needed attention towards eradicating pre-poverty once and for all across the globe.
She's now working to get a menstrual health rights bill passed in South Africa that would allow menstrual hygiene to be classed as a human rights issue.
That report by Jem O'Reilly. Lebanon is in the grip of a deep economic and political crisis, but on Wednesday came a possible lifeline with the arrival of a drilling rig. Operated by a consortium led by the French firm Total Energie, it will begin exploring for oil and gas in Lebanese waters later this month. Here's the Lebanese Transport Minister, Ali Hamir.
For the Lebanese government and the Lebanese people, this is a crucial matter. God willing, before the end of this year, the results will come back positive and Lebanon will become an oil-producing country. So there will be a glimmer of hope for the Lebanese people.
The exploration of what is known as Block 9 has been made possible by a US brokered deal to set up a maritime border between Lebanese and Israeli waters. I heard more from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
This was a long process, went through a lot of issues, as you can imagine, because, I mean, Israel and Lebanon are technically at war with each other, so they couldn't deal with each other directly. The main player, although not politically, but just in a sense of the control that it has over Lebanon, is Hezbollah, which, of course, is extraordinarily anti-Israel and has fought wars with Israel, but there may even be one coming along in the next year or two. So their concerns had to be sort of dealt with. But I think, again, with Lebanon in such a dire economic circumstance, it was felt that this was worth pursuing. So Hezbollah went along with it. In fact, it's a Hezbollah minister who's been talking about it today in the government. So the US brokered that deal last year. It took a lot of very nifty diplomatic footwork to do that. Israel will receive royalties from this if it happens, because part of a field that's going to be explored, a little bit of it is in the maritime area that has been demarcated as belonging to Israel.
And after all they've been through, are people in Lebanon excited by this?
I would think absolutely not, because they are people who have lived through all sorts of problems. So cynicism is kind of a lifestyle there. So I don't think anybody's jumping up for joy. And the fact that their ministers are saying this will give them even less of a sense of confidence. I mean, they have been out on the streets against their government, trying to remove it. Essentially, there isn't a government as such in Lebanon. It's a caretaker government. There's no president. There's no prime minister, except an acting prime minister. And there's no governor of the central bank either, after he resigned essentially in disgrace. But I mean, as you know, even if they do find gas or oil, the development of that will take years. So the actual economic benefits of this won't be massive for a long time. Although, obviously, if it is discovered soon, that will be a boost to the local economy in terms of people coming and working on it. It will be a new industry that will be very beneficial to Lebanon.
Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher. One of the UK's largest tourist attractions, the British Museum, has sacked a member of staff after treasures disappeared. The items, described as historically priceless, include gold, jewellery and semi-precious gemstones. Police are investigating. Robin Brent reports from the museum in central London.
Somewhere inside this building, which has been in the heart of London for 270 years, it's a globally renowned institution, but somewhere inside there is essentially a crime scene tonight. We heard from the British Museum that there are various items that are either missing, stolen or damaged. A member of their staff has been dismissed. So let's look at what we know about what's missing. These are small pieces that were kept inside a storeroom inside this building. They weren't being shown to members of the public, and they include, apparently, gold jewellery, gems of semi-precious stones and glass. Now, they date back to the 15th century BC, and some of the items come all the way up to the 19th century AD. So that means that some of these missing or stolen items could be as old as 3,500 years. Now, we've heard from George Osborne. He's formerly a prominent Conservative politician in this country. He's now the chair of the British Museum. And he said the priorities for them are to find the missing goods and to make sure it doesn't happen again. And he's described this as a sad day for all of those who love the British Museum. But what's clear tonight is not much is clear. They don't have a full inventory of what's gone missing. They don't know where this stuff is. They don't know how long it's been going on for. And they can't place a value on these missing items as well. Some of them, as I said, potentially thousands of years old.
Robin Brandt at the British Museum, not far from us here in central London. Now to an issue which many a parent has struggled with, how to regulate children's use of mobile phones. Last month, the Dutch government announced that from the start of next year, all phones will be banned from classrooms to stop them disrupting learning. From the Netherlands, here's Anna Holligan.
Students' phones have turned some classrooms into battlegrounds.
Teachers end up having big fights with the students, asking them to hand in their phones, and the kids will say, no, it's my property, you can just take it from me.
From January 2024, all devices from smartphones to tablets to watches will be banned in Dutch schools, with a few exceptions, for example, during lessons on digital skills or for students with a medical need or learning disability. Come to the station to meet a friend who is a teacher in a high school here in The Hague. Her name is Asha.
It's a challenge to get the kids off of their phones. It's a challenge to monitor what they're doing on their phones.
Have you ever had any direct confrontation with a student because they just refuse to put down their phones?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. This student was 18 years old, so he could basically do whatever he wants anyways, but he was not learning for his exams, and parents are spending a lot of money on his schooling, so they expect me to take the phone from him. And yes, it was very challenging, and eventually the phone was locked in the locker for the rest of the day. But the result is not what you want, because this boy was so mad at the fact that his phone was locked away that he was not learning anyways. It's best to find a balance instead of choose a fight in this situation. I think it will give calmer learning environments, that's for sure. But I think as soon as the bell rings, the kids will run to their locker and get their phones out. That's the thing that I am a little bit worried about, is that the full break time will be spent on their phones individually instead of together.
Like many teachers, though, Laurie's looking forward to losing the virtual competition.
It's hard enough to get teenagers to focus on their work. If they then have other more interesting things to look at, it doesn't really work because you can't compete with that, really.
Do you think this could have a positive impact on students?
I'm hoping that it will give them a lot more time to focus on what they're doing. And I'm also hoping that it'll be easier for them to connect to each other in the classroom rather than people elsewhere on a screen, which is more abstract.
Dutch schools are still on holiday right now, and interestingly, all the teenagers in this park are on their phones. My daughter Zina's been with me listening to these interviews. So what's this 7-year-old pupil's perspective?
I think that it's probably a good idea to ban phones, but smartwatches are okay because smartwatches are smaller and easier to ignore. If there's an emergency, you can check that on your smartwatch.
The ban on all smart devices is not legally enforceable, but it may become so in the future.
Anna Holligan, reporting from the Netherlands. Finally, have you ever looked at your bank account and wished there was more money in it? Well, a technical glitch in Ireland meant that customers were able to withdraw large sums of cash, often bigger than their balances. Queues inevitably formed at cash points, as Charlotte Gallagher reports.
Videos on social media show people lining up next to Bank of Ireland cash machines. Some are still in their pyjamas and dressing gowns, having rushed out when they heard you could withdraw huge sums of money, no matter how much you had in your account. One man told the Irish Times newspaper, "I don't know if I'll get away with it, but it's worth a shot." The Bank of Ireland admitted a technical fault and warned customers that any money withdrawn would be taken back. It said people should not withdraw or transfer funds if they were likely to become overdrawn. Police were seen guarding some cash machines to deter people from taking advantage of the problem. The Irish police force, known as the Garda Síochána, said officers would remind people of their personal responsibility in carrying out their banking. Some Bank of Ireland customers were also unable to access online banking and the app. The bank says the problem is now fixed and has apologised for the disruption.
Charlotte Gallagher. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.